Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon. It's Friday. It's on August 7th, 2020. And a lot of things have happened since we talked to Jillian. Let's see where she is and what she can bring us up to speed on. Things are changing drastically. And that unraveling, I guess, would be the good word. And we'll see where we are in terms of the universe. Oh, John.
Hello.
Hi there, Russell here.
Yes, hi, Russell.
It's been a while.
I know.
So how have things been going? How do you see things?
I've been enjoying the summer sunshine and trying not to think about all the stuff that's going on in the rest of the world, because I don't think anything I do is going to make much difference. So I'm just trying to enjoy the lovely summer weather.
Okay. But since you've been around a minute or two, a couple of lifetimes, you would have some insights, wouldn't you, by now? Rather than those of us who have just come here for the first time. I'm here for the first time.
Well, first of all, I don't believe anybody's here for the first time.
Come on.
I don't think anybody's the first. No, I don't think so. Very, very few. In all the people I have talked to in my whole life and all the years, 30 years of doing readings for people on a regular basis, you know, full-time job, I don't think I have met more than five or six who were first timers on this planet.
Is that right?
That were humans, yeah. Well, even the extraterrestrials that are here, most of them have been here before, and that's why they decided to come back. So I honestly have met very, very, very few souls who were beginning their experiences first time on Earth.
How can you tell the difference? How can you tell a first-time initiative?
Well, because I'm talking about the people I've actually met and done readings for, people who have given me permission to look at them,
okay.
Right, and at their timeline.
So when I look at their timeline,
I know whether they've been before or not.
All right. I'm going to give you permission to talk to me today. Look at my timeline.
Oh, yeah. Look at your timeline. Okay, well, you've been coming here for a long time. Not as long as many, because you did come from a different location originally. But you have been coming here for sure for 2,000 or 3,000 years. I'd have to really look at too many things to know more than that. But I definitely know you've been coming here for 2,000 or 3,000 years because I see you. A long time ago, the first thing that comes to my mind is you as a Roman military man.
Uh-huh.
When you said you can look, the first thing that jumped out at me was, and you know, probably 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, the beginning, early days of the Roman Empire military. You was in a military outfit. Yes.
Uh-huh. Was I overseeing Rome, or was I looking at Jerusalem, or did I run into Jesus?
Probably all of the above, right? But you were definitely, that was an era in which you did very well. You're a very big man in that time frame. You were not Italian in the sense of Roman. You were a Roman soldier, but looking at you, you probably came from out of the Middle East, Persia, further east than Rome, and you became a Roman soldier.
Uh-huh.
And very, very tall, nice looking, strong, gladiator type build, you know, big build, big man.
For that era,
the average height was only about 5'5" then, and you were probably 6 feet tall. So you were big for that age.
must have been an experience. I don't remember any of that.
I mean, that's as soon as you said I could look. There's other things to be seen as well.
Like what?
If you're interested. Well, at some point, I'm not sure when, but earlier than that, a lot earlier. It wouldn't be earlier. What am I saying? My timeline's not very good. But the Middle Ages, around the time of 12th to 14th century, somewhere in there, and I'm picking up the 12th century, actually, you were a doctor, a healer, and you did that two or three lives in that Middle Ages period, right through to the Renaissance. You were a herbalist, an apothecary, a doctor. So you've been doctoring two or three times, at least. And you know, you often see that on someone's timeline, that when they've had some kind of career, working life, where they were actually involved in killing people, then subsequently in later lives, they choose either healing or teaching, one of the gentler, more service modalities, rather than just killing people. That's a fairly normal thing. But some people, of course, are soldiers forever. You know, they never change. They choose war as their medium, lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. They like it. And funnily enough, it's not usually that they like killing people. It's that they like organizing people. The ones that stay soldiers forever usually like to be organizing people, planning battles and playing war games. The kind of people who end up in the Pentagon, you know, those kind of people.
Sure,
they've done it
yeah.
for a long, long time. But no, you have some interesting history in your background.
All right. So this time I came back to figure out what am I going to do with my life this time. I'm still trying to figure that out.
What are you going to do? Well, I would say that you have somehow chosen a teaching role. I see you in this lifetime in a teaching role. Have you done teaching already in your life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I used to teach the fifth grade, and then I taught the sixth grade. And then later on, I taught college for 10 years. I taught at the Howard University
because,
and Morgan State University.
Well, I didn't know that, but I know you mentioned one time that you'd done something with a college, but I didn't actually know that you were a teacher. And that's what I see the role as this time, that you've moved into a teaching role. And you know, it's the old saying, when we need to learn, we teach. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Which is true. I mean, that's a wonderful saying, and it's so true. And when we've learned what we need to learn from that experience, we stop teaching. We just stop. And if we're young enough, we do something else, right? Mm-hmm. And so, in a way, you are continuing your teaching role with your radio station, with the radio work. You're trying to teach people, you're trying to put information out there. And so if you want to know about this lifetime, it would be good to look at the children that you taught when you were younger, when you were actually doing classroom teaching in a classroom setting, and even up to the college stuff that you did when you were lecturing in college. Look at what it was that you were teaching, what kind of things you were teaching. And then whatever those subjects were, look and see what you learned from that experience, because you were learning two things at the same time. You were learning about the subject that you were teaching about, but you were also learning about the art of communicating to other people in a way that they would understand what you were teaching them. And the younger the children you teach, the more you have to be able to explain what you are teaching. So when you get to college level, you expect the students to be able to absorb from however you put the subject matter to them. They should be able to learn from it. But children, you are teaching, first of all, You're teaching them to learn. You're teaching them how to learn, and you're teaching them the subject material that you're teaching. And from those two things, you are learning. So now, when you took on the radio program and you started putting stuff out on the radio, now you are teaching from what you learned from those earlier experiences. And it may not sound as if it relates, but it does, because we're talking about you and about your soul's experience. And through the teaching in your younger years, you gained something at soul level that enabled you now to take other material and put it out to other people for their information. Mm-hmm. So you're not really... It's a teaching modality. The radio is a teaching modality, but you're not doing it as a teacher. You're doing it as someone who has learned and is now sharing your own experience of learning. Mm-hmm. And so now it can be about any subject that you choose to touch on. It's no longer about what you were previously teaching, but it's about your life's experience and your historic experience, because whether you realize it or not, your past, all the things you've ever done historically, come forward in this lifetime and color your thinking, color your learning, you might say. Mm-hmm. The reason you feel about things the way you do feel about them is not because of the actual, not totally just because of the experience now, but because of all the previous experiences that color your view of the experience now. It's kind of like when you said something to me the last time we were talking, and I said, and you made it about something, well, that's for the last 200 years was your statement. And I said, I'm not looking at it from the point of 200 years. I'm looking at it from the point of 5,000 years when it began. You know, so all your timeline of history actually affects the way you think now. Not just what you remember, but all of it, because you have it. Even if you don't consciously remember it, that has built you to the character you are today. That's given you your character, not just in one lifetime, but in hundreds of lifetimes, and made you the person you are today. Mm-hmm. And that's what's reflecting in your life now, predominantly since you started doing the radio. So if you want to understand yourself now, look at what drives you with the radio show.
Mm-hmm. I like to interview people who have insights in terms of how the behavior of individuals is formed.
Do you want to know? Yes, I do. So do you want me to tell you now what you're going to be doing in the future? Right?
Yes, I do. Yes, please.
You're going to be going back to some school on or off the planet and taking degrees in the form of learning, right, on psychology. And then next time you'll come back in your teaching healing modality as a psychologist, whether it's on the planet, on a spaceship, or on another planet, it's irrelevant. That's the path that you are going on. Because the questions we are asking about are the clues to where we're going. That's where our thinking is taking us. And that's where your thinking is taking you. So you will be doing either, if you're on the planet, you will either be going into psychology or you will be going into anthropology. Those are the two fields that are there for you to move forward in the future. Most predominantly, looking at where you've come from, what your thinking is now, right? Why you think you do what you do now, where it can take you. I mean, it's a very wide field of opportunity, but that's the direction you're going in.
I see. And both of which are very interesting fields, if I may say.
Very, very interesting.
Yeah. For the people who... You are a seer, clairvoyant. And all of your experiences, let's go back a year or two or three or four or five, an incarnation or two. Before this incarnation, what were you doing?
Before this one?
Yes.
Okay, last time I was stretching myself rather, and I had two things going on almost simultaneously, lives overlapping, right? I had one life where I was living in Tennessee. My name was Shaw. I was married to a man called Ben Shaw and lived in Tennessee, and we farmed there. We had a farm. Mm-hmm. And he died in 1849. But overlapping that life, and I can't remember the exact date, but overlapping that life, I was also experiencing a life in England. And of course, all the theologians will tell you that you can't fragment the soul energy. Well, they've got it wrong. You certainly can. When you've collected enough, you can divide it up to speed your own processes up. You can divide up that energy to be in more than one body at once. And in that, in the 1800s, I was also living as a writer in the north of England.
Uh-huh.
And I was one of a family where we wrote things, we wrote books.
Okay. So when you left, why did you leave? And at what age do you think it was that you left?
Left, you mean died?
Yeah. Huh?
Do you mean when I died?
Oh,
transition. I was young.
Yeah.
I was young.
What?
Died, the body gets dead. The soul doesn't. When I leave, my body's dead. So when did my body die? I forget exactly how old I was. I wasn't that old. I was maybe 27, 28, somewhere around there. I died of consumption in England. I died of consumption in England. Now, in Tennessee, I lived till I was quite old. I'm thinking when I buried my husband in 1849, he was about late 60s, 68, something like that. And I lived probably a good 10 years after him. And so I was old when I died.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any children?
We had five children. We
oh.
had a set of twins and two boys and a girl. Yeah,
that
we had five children. And I outlived two of them.
Two
of them died.
When you left, did you try to interface and assist them in their lives and their development, their continuance? Did you cut from the other side? No, just let them go, huh?
No.
I
mean, you have a tendency on the other side to. When you have emotional attachments to people on the planet during the lifetime, after you leave, there is a tendency to want to keep an eye on them. But in fact, you don't have the right to interfere with their life. You just, you know, hope it'll work out well for them, want the best for them, and send them a lot of loving energy on a regular basis. But then once you get to the other side, there is a tendency to be loving anyway. You know, it's what you become. If you've been on the right track, let's put it that way. If you're not in
yes.
the bad place.
Okay.
So, generally speaking, oh, go on. You have a question.
No, go ahead. No, I got a lot of questions. Go ahead.
Well, generally speaking, people get to the other side and they have a tendency, I'm talking about normal, average people living normal, average human lives, normal people. When we're normal, we get to the other side, we go into the astral plane, we continue to maintain the personality that we had in the last life while our soul undergoes its examinations, right? And when we get our soul pieces back and are told what our next choices are, then we tend to really start to let go of what we've left behind. But it's different for everybody. No, I'm just making a real generalization here.
Okay, that's okay.
And, right, everybody's experience is slightly different, and it depends on what attachments they had, what they died of, the state of their emotions and the state of their soul when they actually did die, how much recovery time they need. You know, some people die very traumatically and with a great deal of emotional upheaval, and it can take them years and years and years in the astral plane before they recover, before they recollect themselves, you might say. And then there are other people who, well, they die and the next day they're ready to jump off into something new practically, although that's usually a mistake. Usually returning to the planet too quickly tends to be a mistake because they don't organize themselves. We need thinking time. We need need time to digest the experiences.
I see. So the 8 billion people on planet Earth at this time, somewhere in that vicinity. So you are saying that they all will leave and some will come back again, or all will come back again? How does that work?
Okay. Well, I would say it like this. That every soul which had its first soul experience on this planet will definitely come back. And they will keep coming back until they have finished everything they need to learn on planet Earth. And when they've learned everything they need to learn, they will then have the choice of leaving. There are others who had their first soul experiences on other planets, had done with that other planet either permanently or temporarily, and came to Earth, as you might say, as a guest, a visitor, only to experience one or two things with a life on Earth, maybe one life, maybe two or three, but not many, because it's not their home planet. And as we are coming to the end of a cycle, when the cycle ends, those people will have the choice to either sign up, as it were, for another stretch on Earth or to go back home to their home planets. And most of them, my understanding is, most of them at the end of this cycle, because it's a grand cycle, not just a regular little 50,000-year turnaround, but a huge cosmic closing of a window and opening of a whole new frequency, they will almost certainly, 99% of them will choose to go back home to their own planets where they originated from. Some of them will choose to stay with Earth in the advanced level, in the higher frequency level, if they've earned the right to do it. You know, it's like everything else. You have to work for what you get. It doesn't. There's no such thing as a free meal anywhere in the universe, ever, ever. You have to work for it. And the work never ceases. So long as there is a universe and so long as there are souls, we will be working. In or out of body. Mm-hmm. One or the other.
All right. Then when you do cross over and you work it out in terms of balancing whatever issues that you have to work on and being comfortable to even think about coming back, do you choose how you coming back, with whom you will show up with? Do you choose your parents?
Right. Again, obviously there are exceptions to the rule, and a lot of exceptions to the rule. But as a general rule, about 400 to 500 souls began their physical life's experiences together on this planet, say, or whichever planet they began on, and keep reincarnating with that same group of souls. Like when you go to school, you're in class one, and whoever is in class one moves forward with you right through to college, right? You know, right through the school system. It's the same group of people, with a few exceptions. Some drop out, some change their courses, whatever. But as a general rule, you keep reincarnating with the same group of souls that you started out with. And again, as a general rule, it is a pool of about 400 to 500 souls, because in a lifetime, about 400 is the average number of different people that we interact and connect with in a lifetime. Now, we're talking about normal people leaving normal lives, right? And about 400 is statistically the number that you will connect with. And we generally connect with the souls that we've already had experiences with. Because remember, life on Earth or on any planet is an experience of learning for the soul self, the spirit self, right? So you keep going with the same people because you've had past experiences with, and then that's easier to learn off the same group of people. It's not like halfway through your learning, you might decide, okay, I want to break from this college course I'm doing. I'm going to leave this university and I'm going to go off to another university on a distant place and do a psychology course with them. And then I'll come back here and pick up my learning again. And so that's the kind of thing where we go off and have different experiences. But generally speaking, we interact with the same group of souls. Now, that does not mean that they are the same color, the same race or nationality, or speak the same language. They might be flung to the four corners of the earth, but those are the ones that we interact with in a lifetime by choice, right? We keep doing it. So when we when we choose a new life, we tend to choose one which will put us in a position to interact with that 400 or 500 group of people. May allow us to make connections with them to learn the next set of lessons that we want to learn. The same group that are following the same curriculum. And basically, the curriculum for every human soul is the same. Putting the soul into a situation where it has opportunity to make choices. And by making those choices, expands its awareness and understanding each lifetime and is enabled to grow from being just a basic bunch of energy to something which is in control of itself, exercises free will, and through its choices becomes an expression in itself and of itself of unconditional love. That's the soul story from beginning to end. And it's the soul's choice all the way through. Originally, it's just nothing but the divine spark of the Creator, which is given to an individualized unit of life to say, okay, make something of it. And it takes tens of thousands of years, maybe, but eventually that soul has learned enough that every choice it makes is the same choice as the creation itself would make. And that means it is an expression of perfect, unconditional love itself. That's it. You're done then.
Okay. So when you reach nirvana, unconditional love, what happens then?
Well, then we have to wait and see, don't we?
Okay. But so... yeah,
I don't know what the source thinks, but if you become reunited with the source, with all that is, with the light, then you become one with everything. And when you're one with everything, what next is there? Only the creation knows that. Only God knows that. I don't know. God knows.
Yeah, but here's my dilemma. If you are saying that you have incarnated in this on this planet for the last 4,000 or 5,000 years. Wouldn't you have some idea of what the infinite would be or has done? Or
look, let me say this to you. When I came to this planet this last time, I lived on the planet for 10,000 years. As an Anunnaki, never dying. And I was already, in Earth terms, 65,000 years old then. At least that. I can't. You're asking me to do math that's not in my head. But if you multiply roughly 17 by 3,600, right? However much that is, that's how long I've been alive since I was last born as an Anunnaki. Now, I've been out of commission in some dark place, lost, for about 400,000 years before that, because 400,000 years ago, I came to this planet, right? And then I was reborn into the Anunnaki, and I lived all those other thousands of years and came back here 14,500 years ago. Now, before the 400,000 years, I was in Atlantis and Lemuria. So we're talking about hundreds of thousands of years. I lived on this planet when we had dinosaurs roaming over our heads in Lemuria, and we had to sleep underground, right? So
I see.
I've been here a long time. You have to, the universe is very old, and souls can be very, very old. And I'm nowhere near what people think of as an old soul. The one I refer to, David, who is, as things stand now, the relationships stand now, he's now my grandfather. He is ages older than me, unbelievable ages older, with continuing consciousness, and he's had continuing life as well. And they take a break from it. They go and rest a while. You've heard he describes it as the halls of Amenti, right? Where you go down and you rest and you bathe in the light and you come back again without dying. These are some very long things. Now, you've heard the Pleiadians say they live 1,000 years. Well, they do. That's about their average lifespan. And they don't necessarily have to die then if they don't want to. They've probably had enough after 1,000 years. But Anunnaki, the Anunnaki don't die. You get regenerated. You get a new body to use, maybe. But you, the thing, the being that is you, does not die. And in that context, I can say I have never died. I've had bodies for the last 4,000 years, which are short-term bodies like this physical body I've got now, and they've died. And I was trying to explain to a doctor why it was okay if I got really old and really sick, why I would choose the day that I would end this life, that I would not just put myself in the hands of doctors who would wire me to a lot of tubes in some old people's place just to keep my body ticking over, because I would choose when this body, I would decide when this body was so worn out and so useless and so no good anymore that it was worthless to me to keep it breathing, and then I would terminate it because I know I'll get another body right away. Take me 3 days to get out of this one and get into a new one, because that's what happens to the Anunnaki. In the Bible, there's a thing in the Old Testament that talks about the Book of Life. You're familiar with that?
Yes.
People getting their names in the Book of Life,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Well, the Book of Life, the Book of Life is actually a complete record of the DNA of all the Anunnaki. And every time they come into human form, their DNA is kept at home, you might say. And when they've come and done what they need to do on the planet, in the physical realm, and then leave, they have a new body waiting for them to transfer into, so that they be up and running in 3-4 days. That's about how long it takes to transfer everything about them. And I'm not talking about the cloning that the government does, which is downright evil. They just make replicas of people with no soul energy, no spirit energy at all. They're just biological entities that function. And that's a bad thing to do. But I'm talking about what the Anunnaki do, which is simply prepare another body for you so that you don't have to be reborn. Now, when you join the human cycle on the planet, like I did 4,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago, then I've had to be reborn each time. When I got lost before, I had to be reborn to an Anunnaki mother. They had to find somebody who could, because what happened when I died, the energy just got dissipated. And so it's a whole system. And it really is pure science. Pure science. But most people, it's hard for them to get a grip on. It's hard for them to comprehend.
Well, I guess so.
And most souls who are Earth humans, when they die, they go into the astral plane and their spirit stays there until somebody on the planet is in process of preparing another body, and then they get a chance to choose to take that body when it's ready. And that's the natural physical thing that goes on with Earth humans.
As an Anunnaki, why would you then leave and choose to be reborn? I mean, that's a tough way to go, wouldn't it?
No,
I mean,
it was not choice, right?
Oh.
It was misfortune.
Oh, I see.
It was misfortune. When your soul's energy gets scattered to the four winds, right? You have to be reborn to make a focus for the return of that energy. Let's put it that way.
To recapture
when
all
you
the pieces.
To recapture all the pieces. And it's taken me the last 3,500 years for one body after another being reborn, to recapture all my soul energy that was scattered and destroyed when they killed me down in South America. I was an Anunnaki and they killed me, and they put my, I told you that story, they took out my heart, and while it was still beating, they threw it into the fire. And fire transforms, it changes energy. That's why, although I'm in favor of cremation as the most hygienic thing to do with bodies, right? Because they're just a waste product once they're dead. But it's like George was cremated, but I made this funeral director wait for 72 hours after he died, for 3 days before he could be cremated. And I will have the same instructions from myself. Because if you cremate somebody before the 3 days are up, then you are in danger of making it very difficult for them to hold their soul's energy together. Very difficult.
So you have to wait 72 hours.
Yes, because on average, not always, but on average, when someone passes over, it takes that long to disengage every last bit of spirit energy from the body. The body hangs on to spirit energy. Every cell in your body has got spirit energy in it. And that those cells of the body take about 3 days to let go of the very last bit of spiritual energy. So, you know, if they cremate you the next day or the day after, yeah, you can manage, but you still have to collect yourself. And interestingly enough, they tell me, the ones who have been cremated in less than 3 days, they tell me it feels like being put in a refrigerator, in an ice box. It's when their bodies are burned, it's so icy cold. And I don't like the cold anyway, so I want to make sure that I'm completely gone before they burn the body.
Okay. How about the ashes? What would you do with the ashes after the cremation?
Oh, as far as I'm concerned, they can throw them in the garbage can. I mean, I have George carefully preserved in a box on my bookcase, right, and where I can keep an eye on him. But it's silly of me, really, to do that. And for myself, you know, once I die and they cremate me, then I shall just tell the funeral people, pick up George's ashes as well as mine and just put them in the garbage.
Okay, so you still have his ashes then?
Yeah, I still have George's ashes. Yes, I do. I'm just being sentimental, but.
Okay. All right. No. I asked that question because my wife died in 1985, and I still have her ashes in some in an urn. Would you believe that?
Uh huh. Yeah.
I need to take it to the river and dump them, but they're still sitting there. They're still sitting there.
Yeah. I would never let go of George's ashes. I keep thinking I could put him in the river, or a friend offered to put them in their garden and plant a tree on top of it. And I thought, no, George might not like that. George is stupid, really. It's really, and I know it's stupid. But no, I just like him there on the shelf in his box. I know where he is. Right. And there is, of course, the fact that where your remains are, when you are in spirit, it's easier for you to return to where your remains are.
Oh, I see.
If I want George to visit me, where his remains are, it's easier for him to come. People visit their own graves.
I see. I got it. The other big question then, because, look, in the Catholic, Episcopalian, Methodist, Baptist, LDS, Mormon, all of them keep telling you that when you leave, that's it. But you are saying the body may be destroyed, but you as a soul entity will always live.
Yes.
People don't think that. I think that's why a lot of people have that fear of death, right? The fear of being extinction.
Well, actually, if they are Christian, the Christian churches teach that there is life after death.
Yes.
And Christ makes that promise of eternal life, right?
Right.
But
right.
He makes the promise by saying, if you do as I tell you,
true.
If you believe what I'm telling you, you can have eternal life. The thing that the religions have done is turn that around and saying, because we killed Jesus or tried to kill him, because we nailed him up on a tree, that guarantees you eternal life. And of course, that's nonsense. That there's no logic in it. If you think about it, the universe is very logical. Things don't happen unreasonably. Right? There's always a reason for it, and it's very logical. So it's not logical to say you are potentially a soul that's, you know, a separate individual soul. You have your own life. You come to this planet, and if you are good, you can live forever, and if you're bad, you can burn forever. There's no logic in that. That doesn't obey any law of science anywhere. And of course, it's not surprising that religions get it so wrong, because science gets it so wrong as well. Science is so certain that it's right about everything, right? And, because Newton said this about gravity, or because Einstein said this about relativity, then this must be correct, and this is the way the universe is. When in point of fact, when they were laying down those foundations of how the universe must be, the only measurements they could take were in feet and inches off the planet itself. They didn't even have the Hubble telescope. They had no way of measuring anything except what was seen from the surface of the planet. Even things like the Nazca lines, they couldn't see them until they learned to fly. Right?
That's true.
So all the basis of science that scientists swear by today is coming from a wrong perception. It's coming from the perception of a man standing here looking out, and that's not a universal perception. So even some of the most fundamental things that they hold to be, you know, absolutely sacrosanct are wrong. For instance, any scientist who talks about the Big Bang will tell you, and it's in all the books on science and everything they teach, this is so hot and it gets so hot and it explodes, and And all this energy goes out, and as it cools down, then you get planets forming and stardust, and the stardust coalesces and that's entirely backwards. The Big Bang occurs at the beginning of a universe with an explosion of light out of a black hole, right? And that explosion of light coalesces and forms a ball, and that ball gathers up all the intelligence around it. And that ball, before it explodes to create a new universe, is cold, unbelievably cold. Science will tell you that at that level of coldness, nothing can move. Well, they're wrong, right? Science will tell you that you can't have a cold explosion creating life. They are wrong again, because what happens when that cold, unbelievably cold explosion occurs, particles of light go out, passing through intelligence. They pick up the intelligence, which is a frequency wave in the light. That light travels out. As it passes other particles of light, it creates friction. That friction heats it up. And when it gets warm enough, then it starts to coalesce into particles of stardust. And then the stardust gets the particles coalesced. And it's as the heat generates that they start to coalesce and form stars and planets. And you go on from there creating solar systems. But they've got it completely backwards. They've also don't understand time at all. Time is like a great river that varies depending on where it is. But it has a constant of time. But it varies in the time it takes to pass time. It's like, time is a hard concept because it is constant, but it varies. The constancy of the particles that create the wave of time don't vary, but the distance and speed with which it travels varies. So 1 hour stays 1 hour, but it takes it 2 hours to pass some places and only 1 hour to pass others. So sometimes, I don't know, it's a hard concept, but how long it takes to be an hour depends on the magnetic fields of the planets that time is flowing past or around. Mm-hmm. It's really, time is very, very interesting. And well worth a lot of consideration.
I see.
It actually represents the diastole of the source. It's almost like, you know, the creator breathes out the creation. And when it pauses for breath, that's when you have the manifest reality of the creation with time flowing through it.
I tell you, it's a big mystery. Even thinking in terms of how all of this started, it's a challenge to one's imagination.
It is, because you have to have imagination, and you can imagine whatever you like, because the reality is nobody knows.
Nobody knows. Even the
Anunnaki. We do know things. I told you before, their cosmology, you know, that they know that a universe exists and keeps expanding exponentially, using the mathematics of pi to expand with. They know how it expands and everything. They know all about the universe, and they know eventually it goes out like waves or frequency waves, right? And there are multiple levels of experiencing, multiple frequencies on which you can experience that universe, from very, very dark to very, very light. But as it expands, it gets to the full expansion of the light that's available. In other words, the universe has become fully manifest to the farthest extensions possible. And then it starts to implode on itself and goes back darker and darker and darker until it ends up in a black hole. And it springs out of the other end of the black hole as light again.
Wow.
And they know that. Wow. They know that's how the universe infinitely continues. And they know how it manifests. but they don't know who started it or how long it's been going or how long it's going to go. They don't know when the end of infinity is, and they don't know who created it in the first place.
Wow, wow. Even the Dracos or the Reptilians or the Greys or the Nordics, no one knows? No one knows.
No one knows. No one knows.
Wow. So we're all stumbling around.
The Draconian Reptilians didn't even come from our universe. When our universe came into play, the Anunnaki have calculated, in some way they know this. Mm-hmm. The Anunnaki will say, when our universe came into being, 294 other universes came into being simultaneously. So all these different universes came into being. And one of the universes is a reptilian universe, start to beginning to end. Beginning to end is a reptilian universe. And at one point, eons and eons ago, there was a malfunction, you might say, in the electrical field at the source, at the core, where the creations spring out from. And because of that malfunction, some of those reptilians were able to move from their experiencing universe into our universe. And they made a home for themselves on the planet Draco. And from there, they have grown, they've developed, they've become a space-traveling race, space-faring people, and now they're all bad news to planet Earth. Bad news, because they're intrinsically different to us, and all their desire is for power. All they want is power and control in our universe. They don't belong here at all. They don't belong here at all. Now, that's not the same as the reptilians who belong on Earth. The ancient beings from the time of the dinosaurs, there were some highly developed humanoid species on the planet at the time of the dinosaurs who were reptilian in nature and who belong on this planet from most ancient times. And they are not particularly bad creatures. I mean, I guess there's some good and some bad among them. They certainly would like to have a more powerful situation on the planet than they have in modern times, you know, but they've always been here. They are indigenous to planet Earth, but the Draconian reptilians, they are not indigenous even to our galaxy, let alone our universe. And they are really bad news.
But
badly.
They got through,
and they're the ones who are advising or working with governments, the governments of the world, and also corporations on our planet. Until I read those books recently, and this is on-planet information, my off-planet information was, yes, the Draconians are there, this is their history. This is how they got here. And yes, they trade with the governments on the Earth for the right to do experiments on the planet and with the people, to snatch a few people and do it. And they're bad news. And we try to keep them at bay. That was all I ever knew. And I knew there were just a few thousand of them in ships, 9 ships usually circling our planet. It's only since and that's information from when I was a young girl, right? And I've never asked about it since. And then when I read those books, it was a real shocker to me to discover how powerful they've come through their interactions with people like that whole group of American people and global people. You know, that whole bunch who meet in California every year and do offerings to Buffett. People like the Clintons and the Bill Gates and all those kind of people, they are all involved with the reptilians. And I'm sorry to say, according to David Icke, even the British royal family, the Queen and some of the royal family are involved with them. I don't know I don't know whether that's true or not. It may be. But certainly it seems as if all the people who hold power in the material world are getting it because they are getting knowledge and information and insight from the reptilians, who are themselves very powerful, the draconian reptilians specifically.
Mm-hmm. All right. How will the effects of 2025, you said that may happen faster, how will that change things in terms of where we're going, the Dracos?
In terms of the universe, it's a frequency change. It's a frequency shift. And so what it means for all those people who have been making genuine efforts to evolve spiritually as beings, to progress, it's a huge window of opportunity for them to move into a whole new level of learning. They will be able to leave all the old patterns and habits. It's like a new earth. You know, before the flood, before the great flood, when humans were not as, they were not self-governing. Before the flood, they were not self-governing. And this planet was truly, the whole planet, was like a Garden of Eden. I mean, everything grew everywhere. You know how it is when you go to the tropics and you've got lush natural growth everywhere and animals all over the place and everybody's nice and friendly, nobody's being nasty and vicious, and you've got fruit growing everywhere, and you really don't need to be into agriculture and things like that because there's everything there that you need, right? And that's how the planet was. And then Earth, after the flood, and man was reinstituted and developed and left to his own devices. The planet was handed over to him and say, okay, you know, there's so many of you now. You just look after yourselves and you see what's happened. You see the very impoverished state the planet itself is in. And we have done that to it. We have made it that way, but it wasn't always like that, and it won't be again. So when you get this post-shift, this post-change, what will be available to experience will be as it was in the beginning, right? A more beautiful environment with the opportunity to experience it like it used to be. Right, a new frequency to experience life, a more evolved frequency, and that's available for everybody who has made the effort to become a more enlightened being, and that means something different to everybody. Right, it's no particular one path. It simply means really obeying the golden rule. You know, treat others the way you'd like to be treated. And if people have been living a life like that, they don't need to have any religion or any belief structure or any knowledge of metaphysics or anything else. If they've been living right, they will have the chance to move into a higher frequency. The majority, 2/3, 3/4 of the people have not made that effort. Despite warning after warning after warning, they have not made the effort. So whatever degenerative state this existing environment moves into, they will sink with it. They told me years ago that this planet in 2 generations could get back to being like the Stone Age. It could get really primitive. Yeah.
Is that right? Wow.
Well, because here's the thing. These superpower people, right, that run things right now. And, you know, we all know who we're talking about, the really bad people on this planet, people like Hillary Clinton and Bill Gates, who is an absolute nightmare, and the Pope and the Pelosi's, all these really bad people that are running the game now are in charge. in cahoots with the reptilians and benefiting from all the reptilian technology, right? I mean, think about where Bill Gates got all his Microsoft from. He stole it from the Apple people originally. His first thing was stolen, and he went on with there. And all these people who make their wealth and their power through all the technology, right? The technology cannot buy them a place in the higher frequency. You can't move into the higher frequency through technology. There isn't any technology that can shift you from one frequency to another. It's not about it's not about technology. And so you can only move from one spiritual frequency to another spiritual frequency through spirit. You can't say, I don't like the energy of where I'm living. I don't like this spiritual frequency. So I want to move to a higher experience of life, a higher frequency. So I'll get in my spaceship and do it. Moving to a higher frequency is not the same thing as making things appear and disappear, right? Like you see some spaceships and you can't see them, and then they start to glow and you can see them. That's technology. That's cloaking devices, right?
Oh, I see. I see.
That's not the same as moving into another frequency. And those who are not evolved cannot move from one frequency to another. So what is this evolution we're talking about? It's spiritual evolution. It's the development by their own choices of choosing to be something better, constantly trying to be better, a better person, a better human being. And what is a better human being? Somebody who has more consideration for others than they do for themselves. That's all it is.
In closing, and I really appreciate you kind of clarifying that for us today. In closing, do you get involved in out-of-body experiences even now before you decide to leave here? You do?
Yes, sometimes. Sometimes I do.
But most people can't. Is that right? Or do they have the ability to do that?
Almost everybody does. Right?
Oh.
They just don't know they're doing it. Right?
I see.
Out of body is the normal experience for every spirit. Every night when you go to sleep. When you go to sleep, I sometimes think it's not because your body needs the sleep, it's because your spirit needs a break. It needs to get out of here, right? And most people, when they sleep, they leave their bodies. Their spirit leaves and goes off. And one of the things that I used to teach years and years ago was what the Native American Indians call true dreaming, right? And it's a very... It's an art. You can learn, right? When we are dreaming, we are often having an out-of-body experience. And the doctor people tell you that when you have rapid eye movement, REM, right? We've all heard of REM. They say, well, that's when you're dreaming. Well, that's not true, right? It's another thing they've got wrong, right? So wrong.
Mm-hmm.
The rapid eye movement occurs when you are processing the experiences that you've had out of body, right? So there are two kinds of dreaming. There's the dreaming that's just your brain going crazy because you ate pickles at bedtime and you've got indigestion. Right. Or you watch something frantic on television before bedtime and now your brain is going over and over again what happened on the television. Right. But here's the thing with true dreaming. When you want to remember something, like, and I think I mentioned this to you before as a learning tool, when you go to, say, a lecture, and they're showing a video and they're talking while they're showing the video at this in this lecture hall. and you go and you're really interested and you want to learn from it and you want to remember. So as the speaker is speaking, every time the slide comes up on the screen or every time he says something that you want to remember, you blink your eyes. Blink, blink, blink. Because your eyes are like a camera. You are, every time you blink, you are locking that sound picture that's being focused at you. You're locking it into your brain. You're taking a picture of it and you're locking it into your brain. Now, when you are sleeping and you have dreams that are not because you've got indigestion or a headache, there's nothing physically going wrong, right? You're in good shape. You're in a nice restful sleep, and then you go out of body and you start having an experience, and you have that experience for maybe half an hour, 10 minutes, it doesn't matter how long it is, and then your spirit self returns to the body. When you return to the body, your eyes start to blink because you are locking into the brain what you remember of the experience that you've just had. When your brain gets hold of it, that data is fed into your brain with your blinking eyes, your rapid eye movement, then it processes it and it tries to fit it into slots that it can understand. To give you an example of what I mean, supposing you go out of body and you are flying, you're floating over a maze, and you're looking down at this maze and all the different pathways going every which way, maybe among a hedge or trees or whatever, and you're looking at this, and then you come back from the experience and you fed it in the data into your brain, and what your brain gets out of it is a bowl of spaghetti, right? Because when the computer of the brain tries to work out what you've seen, it thinks you were looking at a bowl of spaghetti. So you wake up and you say, oh, I was dreaming about spaghetti last night. You weren't actually dreaming. That's what your brain made of it. But the actual experience was something quite different. Now, you can teach yourself fairly easily to remember the dreams and remember them correctly, so you can then think about them in a conscious state. So here are the clues for doing that. First clue, have a ring or a bracelet or something that you wear frequently, or, you know, maybe a mole on your leg or whatever, but something that is with you almost every day of your life. And for a lot of people, the easy thing is a wedding ring, an engagement ring, something like, rings are easier to do, right? But something that's normally there every day of your life. And then train yourself, when you go to sleep, be thinking, being, have a real clear picture in your mind of that hand and that ring on that hand. And then when you start dreaming, you go out of body and you're dreaming, in your mind, make yourself, make your mind, which is not your brain, right? Make your mind focus on that ring on your hand. And when you've got the ring straight in front of you and you can look at it and see it exactly as it is, then you can say, okay, now I can go and participate in this dream. In other words, you have made yourself fully conscious, your mind fully conscious, whilst you are in that dream state. And then you go and you're out of body, you've got your mind with you, you've got your consciousness with you, and you can move about and interact with that dream and see what's being presented to you and do with it whatever you wish to do. And then you keep, if you keep losing it, if you keep losing control of the dream, make yourself go back to that ring. Back to the ring, because that restabilizes you. It puts you back in control, and then you carry on. And then when you go back into your body, the data is fed into your brain, and when you wake up, your brain will remember the dream very clearly. And then you can lie in bed thinking about it. before you do anything else for the day, have 5 minutes to think through what you experienced. And then sometime later when you have time, you can go back to it because you've got it anchored now in your brain, and you can think about it and you can learn from it, because it's one way that your spiritual guides, angelic beings, off-planet friends, they use that as a tool to teach you. They put you into experiences which will be helpful to you and will teach you. Learning to manage your dreams is one of the most useful things you can do for yourself. It's extremely useful tool for learning and for directing you on your path of spiritual development. More than any other tool you can ever develop. That is the most useful that I know of.
And the next one is to say, I am a human being becoming, help me to become.
You know, that was a little phrase of George's. Yes, it's a useful little phrase. It really is.
Asking.
Because you're giving you're inviting them to show you. Right. You're inviting them, and the dreaming is one of their main tools of being able to interact directly with you and give you information. And you don't always know what it's about. You know, last week I had an experience in the night, and through the whole process, there was this white bear, and it was just a young bear and a very nice one, like a giant shaggy teddy bear. And it kept coming and hugging me. And I was trying to understand, what is this bear? And I still haven't worked it out. I don't know what the white bear was doing, but it was very interesting, and it was a nice bear. It was a nice bear. So you don't always understand. But the interesting thing is, something usually happens down the line in your life, and you remember that dream, and you think, oh, that's what that dream was about.
I see.
So there's always a reason for it.
Right.
Plus,
they
can be fun experiences. Learn to control your dreams, and you can fly all over the world. You know, once you get out of body, you can do all kinds of things.
That's true. Remote viewing, whatever. Listen, thank you very much. I really appreciate the clarification. I really appreciate talking with you again. I just wanted to see how things were going. We haven't spoken in a while. And on planet Earth, things are topsy-turvy and developing.
Yes. Yes.
But
in a happy way.
But they say out of every adversity, there's an equal and opposite benefit. So.
Well, if we learn the benefit, it's an opportunity to learn, you know?
Yeah.
Everything in life is an opportunity to learn. And really, that's all we're trying to do is learn.
Yeah.
And it's not for nothing. You know, we're not learning for no purpose. You do realize that, right? I hope that we're learning so that we can learn to make the right choices to become enlightened beings, so that we can put light out into the universe instead of taking light from the universe, and therefore expand the life of our universe. The longer we can pour light into it, the longer it can exist.
Right.
Now that's
a
thought. If every single living soul in the entire universe magically became enlightened, right, fully enlightened beings, we'd have an eternal universe. As it is, the light will slowly get all used up and will sink into darkness and be sucked into a black hole. In other words, our existence is entirely dependent upon ourselves. For all time, forever.
Okay. All right. Well, I really appreciate you, and I thank you. So here's my wish for you is to stay happy and stay safe.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate your calling, and you know I enjoy talking with you. So thank you.
We enjoy listening because we will learn. Eventually, we will learn as much as you know.
You know what? I know what I know compared to the universe would fit on the head of a pin. I'm still in junior class myself, so let's hope we can all move forward. We can all learn from each other, I hope.
I'm sure. We will continue to do that. Thanks again, Mia.
Thanks. Bye now.
All right, talk to you soon. Have a good weekend.
Yeah. Bye, dear.
Okay,
thanks.
Bye-bye now. Bye-bye now.